We do thank you very much for this opportunity to be together here as a part of your family. Father, we know that we'd be scattered all over this earth and wouldn't even know each other except through the fellowship we have through your Spirit with you and with Christ and with one another. So we thank you now that we can be a part of the body and a part of the house that you're building, a part of the temple. We ask that you'd help us to realize the miracle of changing humans into the family of God. We might have persistency and patience. We might recognize the great effort that it takes to be in your kingdom. So we ask that you'd help us to be men of force to take your kingdom, because we know no one's going to just float in. We do ask now that you would be with us here in this Bible study tonight as we're especially studying Learn Wisdom and the Proverbs. We just ask that you'd be with Mr. Armstrong and his traveling tomorrow and set your angels about the plane and give them good health and favor and inspiration and insight, foresight, all the things that are needed, that he might continue to do your work and lead us as your people. So we just ask your presence here, and we do ask that you would especially bless all the people who've had the character and the hungering and thirsting after righteousness enough to make themselves come out this evening and not stay home and waste time either watching television or just idly gabbing with each other, but that we can be here to drink in of your word and learn your holy scriptures. So we ask your inspiration for that purpose and commit this class into your hands and give you thanks for it. In Jesus Christ's name, amen. Okay, we're in chapter 20. Beginning verse 15. There is gold and a multitude of rubies, but the lips of knowledge are even a greater precious jewel. So once again, comparing the values that humans seem to esteem the greatest, gold and rubies, and comparing that with having a good knowledge and a good mind and having stored up information. Verse 16, another verse on surety. Take his garment that's surety for a stranger, and take a pledge of him for a strange woman. Now, of course, that's kind of a conflict with God's law that said you can't take a person's garment as a pledge that they'll pay you back a loan that you give to them. So God is showing in contrast to that, that anyone who becomes surety for a stranger might as well just go ahead of time and forfeit his garment. Take a pledge of him for a strange woman. Then verse 17, bread of deceit is sweet to a man, but afterward his mouth shall be filled with gravel. So when you think about what it's like when you fall in the sand, you get a mouthful of sand or you get a mouthful of dirt or rocks, then that's what it's going to be like afterward. If you are crafty and crooked and fraudulent and deceptive in the way you gain your income. So there are a lot of warnings in the Proverbs about types of professions you can't be in and be a Christian. So you can't be a lying salesman. You can't be a deceptive salesman, because at first, it might seem great to be earning big money shading the truth a little bit, fudging a little bit, talking people into what they can't afford. But at the end, it's going to be like having a mouth full of gravel. Verse 18, another one on counsel. Every purpose can be established by counsel. Now, of course, if you don't have counsel and you set purposes, many times they're going to crumble and you can't bring them to pass. But every purpose is established if you seek proper counsel and if you have good advice before you go out to war. Otherwise, you may get whipped and defeated and lose everything you think you have. So there are many verses about counsel. This is another one of them. Previous one, if you want to chain references, back in 19, verse 20. Verse 19, another one about the tongue. He that goes about as a talebearer reveals secrets. Therefore, meddle not. Now, in many cases, the word meddle really should be mingle or associate with. So here he's telling you it isn't wise to associate or mingle with someone that flatters with their lips. So you ought to choose the company you keep by whether they flatter with their lips or whether they go about as a talebearer. Verse 20. Whoso curses his father or his mother, his lamp shall be put out in obscure darkness. Of course, this goes way back to the statement in Exodus 21, verse 17, about cursing your father or your mother. Another law in Leviticus 20 and verse 9 about anybody that curses their father or mother. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean by swear words or by rough language. That can mean by conduct or by you're representing the family name. You can be a curse to a father or mother. But that type of living is going to be, you're not going to be known. You're going to be such an obscure light, nobody will be able to see you. You'll be a nobody, is what he's saying. Verse 21, dollar bill verse, along with verse 23. An inheritance may be gotten hastily at the beginning. Of course, everybody has their dreams about a rich uncle dying or somebody leaving an inheritance. But God says, an inheritance gotten hastily at the beginning, but the end thereof shall not be blessed. It isn't good for you to get a large sum quickly without having to work for it, because what will you do with it? It doesn't teach you persistency. It doesn't teach you hard work. It doesn't teach anything that's lasting. So the end of inheritance gotten hastily isn't blessed. Then verse 22 is dealing with revenge. Don't say I'm going to get even or I'm going to recompense evil or you'll wish you hadn't done that. Wait on the Eternal. He'll save you. God says the sin catches up with the sinner and he pays for it. So you don't need to take vengeance on the sinner. Verse 23, different weights and abomination, where you have different stones that look alike, but they don't weigh the same, that you put on the scales depending on whether it's coming in or going out. So different weights are an abomination unto the Eternal. False balance is even worse, isn't good. Of course, there again, that term is not good is misleading in the English language, because the way of saying it in the Hebrew would mean a false balance is bad, very bad. It is not good, not good. So it doesn't mean the way you take it in the King James that it's not as bad or it's milder. That isn't what it's saying. Verse 24, man's goings are of the Eternal. How can a man then understand his own way? So the best way to know yourself is from the Bible, from God's warnings. because your ways seem right in your own eyes, and all of your ways are pure in your own eyes. So in order to really get to know yourself, you have to see yourself through God's eyes. Verse 25, it's a snare to the man who devours that which is holy, and after vows to make inquiry. Now, that means stealing your tithe and paying it back. Of course, that means taking what you ought to give to God and making excuses for it. Some things are holy, and once they're holy, that means they're consecrated to God. They're out of a human's right or a human's judgment. Verse 26, a wise king scatters the wicked. We've read that one before. Brings the wheel over them. In other words, they get caught up with, and their ways find them out. Verse 27, the spirit of man is the candle of the eternal, searching all the inward parts of the belly. In other words, the only way a man knows the things of a man is by the spirit of man that's in him. So that's the way a man is able to come to understand his carnal self. It's like a light, the spirit of man. No animal can know the things of a man and plan and change and repent and think, and only man can do that because of the spirit of man that's in him. Verse 28, mercy and truth preserve the king. His throne is upheld by mercy. So you might remember that when you're in the kingdom of God as a king and a priest. Mercy and truth. That's what always has to be there to preserve your throne, to uphold your throne. Now, maybe it'd be wise to mark verses that deal with kings, because you're going to see a little later in one chapter, chapter 25, a great deal of it talks about kings. And what we're going to have to be before we'll be made kings. So we can't learn these things afterward. We've got to learn them before. Verse 29, the glory of young men is their strength. The beauty of old men is the gray head. Because it should suggest experience and wisdom and knowledge, understanding. But the glory of young men, and you see that all the time, athletic prowess or weightlifting muscle or strutting around like banty roosters thinking girls are captivated by their physique, and most girls could care less. They're not attracted that degree to the man's body. But it shows how foolish it is that young men glory in their strength, but older men glory in their gray head, hopefully justly. Now, verse 30, the blueness of a wound cleanses away evil. It's a purging cure, literally in the Hebrew, against evil. Of course, if you get redness around the wound or a red streak going away from a wound, you know you're in trouble. But on the contrary, if there's the blueness there, then the poison's being carried away and it's actually in the process of healing. So it's a pretty good insight into God's knowledge about healing and wounds and medicines. So anytime you have a sore or a wound and there's blueness, then it's being healed and cleansed. Now that's the way the stripes do, the inward parts of the belly. So the only way some people can ever be cleansed of their evil is by stripes. Either literally by whipping criminals to get them to change, or else the hard knocks and punishment they go through in other ways that are symbolical of stripes. But that's the way you clean up the inward parts of the belly. Now, chapter 21, the king's heart is in the hand of the eternal. So he can soften it like he did Cyrus, or he can harden it like he did Pharaoh's. So the king's heart is in the hand of the eternal. As the rivers of water, he turns it wherever he wills. So God can cause rains to fall and cause rivers to change their courses, and that's the way you can do a king's heart. Verse 2, every way of a man is right in his own eyes. So unless you're converted and have God's Spirit and God's Word to stop that, that's why a man will argue even when he's wrong. Because he has to insist, every way of a man is right in his own eyes. But God will really let you know your real heart. God will cause you to be willing to see yourself the way you really are. The Eternal ponders the heart, so if you want to see yourself the way you really are, then you have to see yourself through God's eyes. Otherwise, your every way is pure, right in your own eyes. Now, in verse 3, it shows the fact that some men in the Old Testament understood the New Covenant, the Spirit of the Law, and they actually saw beyond the physical letter of the law. And this is a good verse to prove that. To do justice and judgment is more acceptable to the Eternal than sacrifice. So you could just go about with diligent ritual sacrifice, very rigidly following the sacrificial law perfectly, and yet in God's sight, to do justice and judgment would be more acceptable to God. Now, how do you know whether you're doing justice and judgment? Well, you have to know God's laws to know whether you're doing justice or judgment. There's no other way you can know what is justice and what is judgment. Verse 4, an high look and a proud heart. You might just mark vanity after this verse, because it doesn't only show the high look, but the proud heart, and the plowing of the wicked is sin. So, sin isn't only what you do you shouldn't do, but sin is even an attitude of heart. Sin is even an air, a cocky, banty rooster, strutting peacock air, and high look. Maybe you advance because of hard work or intelligence or inheritance, and you end up wealthy or powerful. But in God's sight, in high look, is just as wicked as the plowing of the wicked is sin. And the same way with a proud heart, which means an independent or a free-thinking self-will. So a lot of people may be ritually abiding by God's law and the letter vigorously, and yet they're not doing it any differently than the Pharisees. Their righteousness doesn't exceed the scribes and Pharisees. They still have a high look and a proud heart. They're not converted. Verse 5, the thoughts of the diligent tend only to plenteousness. So if you're a person of a lot of get up and go and a lot of diligence and energy, even your thinking tends to work out to more, to plenteousness. But if you're a sluggard, even your thinking isn't productive. It's a dud like you are if you're a sluggard. But if you're diligent, you can't be diligent without your thinking being diligent. And that'll be the tend to plenteousness. Of everyone that's hasty. Now, God condemns over and over and over this daydreaming about one day you're going to hit it rich. One day you're going to hit your oil well. One day your ship's going to come in. One day your rich uncle's going to die. You know, we have proverbs by the dozens that way. But God plainly says, everyone that's hasty, his thoughts are going to tend only to want. Useless thoughts. Empty, non-productive thoughts. Sitting around daydreaming about inheritance, or when your well comes in, or when your ship comes in. Another financial verse, 5 and 6 are both dollar bill. The getting of treasures by a lying tongue. Now, if you're really a converted Christian, how could you make your life's income by being a pharmacist, by carrying a gun and being a policeman, by milking 300 cows on the Sabbath day, You know, there are certain things you cannot do in being a Christian. You can't get treasures by a lying tongue. Otherwise, that's a vanity tossed to and fro of them that seek death. I remember a man used to be over in Illinois, and we mentioned to him about some businesses you just can't be in and be a Christian. He had a bunch of cows and made money with a dairy. So he thought, you know, he'd go to another area where that hard-nosed preacher wasn't there and go ahead with his dairy. So he moved to another area, went right on with his dairying. And guess where I got transferred? When I got transferred from Chicago, right smack where that man was. So there's hard-headed, hard-nosed Blackwell there again, you know, telling him he can't have all those cows and be a Christian. Well, it's sad that a minister should have to tell anybody that. You know, how could anybody think they're a Christian and take money in ways that aren't legitimate? You know, when we ask Mr. Armstrong different questions about professions and whether you can do this and that and still be a Christian, he takes a total different approach. He says, well, how's that preparing you for the kingdom? You know, he doesn't take the approach, the Pharisaical, legalistic, yea or nay approach that we tend to want to ask him. He'll always back off and say, wait a minute, why would a guy allow himself to be in that? How's that going to enhance his chance to be in the kingdom? So think how many proverbs we've read about getting treasure in a crooked way. You know, that's why Paul said you should provide things honest in the sight of all men. So the getting of treasures by a lying tongue, I don't know how much of a salesman I could be, you know. I know my brother went out to Indiana and he found out that farmers over there had no provision for their family at all in case they died or got killed in an accident. So he felt like he was doing them a service when he could go in and try to make them realize their responsibility in God's sight for the family. But once that group was covered, then what do you do? Well, how can you go on being a salesman, preying on the poor, or talking people into what they can't afford? You never could do that. And if you have God's Spirit, you'd be condemned in your conscience all the time. Well, verse 7, the robbery of the wicked, what they get by their robbery, shall destroy them, because they refuse to do judgment. So they're not fair, they're not just, they don't go by what God says is Christian or righteous judgment. So their very robbery is going to end up destroying them. They'll get killed in their robberies. Somebody will kill them to take away things that they've taken in robbery. You know, one way or another, the robbery of the wicked is what ends up putting an end to him. How many people have you known of that were robbers that lived to be 102 years old? Or even 80 years old? Well, verse 8, the way of man is forward and strange, but as for the pure, his work is right. So here again, just showing what human nature is like. It's deceitful and desperately wicked, and it's crooked, selfish, and fraudulent. The way of man is forward and strange. Verse 9, it's better to dwell in a corner of the housetop. In other words, it's better to be a bachelor in an apartment than in a penthouse apartment. It's better to be a bachelor in a corner of a barn. No, it's better to be a bachelor in anywhere where there's peace and quiet than with a brawling woman in a wide house. So no matter how big your house is, if you're married to a woman that's a woman of strife and contentions, a woman of brawling, then you'd be better off being a bachelor in a cheap place than a hideout in a little bitty sleeping room somewhere. So there is something worse than being not married, and that's being married to the wrong person. That's far worse than not being married. Being wrongly married. The soul of the wicked desires evil. His neighbor finds no favor in his eyes. So anytime you're around anybody that's wicked, no matter who you are, whether you're kinfolk, whether you're friends with their parents or what, they're going to always be plotting and scheming, stealing and corruption and wrong, because their very soul gets bent that way and gets steeped in that. And they're just going about desiring evil all the time. So even a neighbor, even a friend of the parents or a friend of the relatives, you know, thieves know no kinfolks. Thieves will steal from anybody. When the scorner is punished, the simple is made wise. But that's always the key of solving a problem, you know. You have to get down to where's the fly in the ointment, you know. Where's the scorner? Where's the rotten egg in the basket? Where's the rotten apple in the bushel? Somewhere there's the rotten apple and the rotten egg, and you have to find that scorner. And then when that scorner's punished, then others that were influenced by him, that were just simple, then they can be made wise. But you'll never be able to make the scorner wise. All you can do with the scorner is punish him to teach others about him. Now, we've seen that a couple of times already. But a wise person, when they're instructed, they'll receive knowledge. But if somebody's simple who's caught up in following a scorner, the only way to teach them anything is seeing the scorner punished. Verse 12, the righteous wisely considers the house of the wicked, but God overthrows the wicked for their wickedness. So when you think about the house of the wicked, look at the house of Saul. What happened there? Well, we ought to consider the house of the wicked. God overthrows the wicked for their wickedness, and their house is not established. Their lamp goes out. You know, they're like the one that cursed their father and mother. Their ancestry doesn't continue. Look at Joab's house. What happened to Joab's household? What about Nebuchadnezzar's house? Well, if we're going to be righteous, then we should wisely consider the house of the wicked. Now, maybe you can think of others in our day. Casting dynasty. Verse 13. Whoever stops his ears at the cry of the poor. Now, that means they don't want to hear about it. And, you know, Americans are that way. And the newspapers and magazines censor a lot of the truth of the conditions around the world, because they know Americans can't stand to always be seeing about the poor in India and the poor here and yon and everywhere. And, you know, even young people, when parents try to get young people to eat everything and not waste anything and take good care of their clothing and all, and they throw up in your face the old proverb about, yeah, remember, they're starving in China and they're naked in South America. And, you know, they throw that up in your face almost as if it's a chide or something. Well, it shows that attitude. It isn't the attitude of someone that just won't help the poor. It's the attitude of someone that doesn't even want to hear about it. It makes them feel bad to be told about conditions of other humans around the earth. So the way God words it, they stop their ears at the cry of the poor. Then somewhere on down the line, they're going to cry themselves, and they're not going to be heard. So your sins find you out. You reap what you sow. So if people don't have ears open to the need of the poor, then God may just say, well, I guess they'd like to experience a little of it themselves and learn. Verse 14, here again is the bribe. A gift in secret pacifies anger, and a reward in the bosom, strong wrath. You know, you get a little bit suspicious when you get stopped by a state patrolman, and his very first question out of his mouth is, who do you work for? You know, you think, well, what's that got to do with anything? You know, what did you stop me for? Did I run a sign or go too fast, or what's that got to do with anything? but that's about the first thing they ask. But God says a bribe in secret pacifies anger. In how many cases, it's not whether you're guilty or innocent, it's a matter of who do you know, whether you can afford bond. A reward in the bosom pacifies strong wrath. It's joy to the just to do judgment. Now, the more of God's law you learn, then the more of a joy it is to you, because then the more you know you're doing justice the way God says. So that's really a Christian spirit. If you're just, then it's a joy to you to do judgment. But destruction is what's going to come to the way of the workers of lawlessness. People that don't want to know what God says, people that don't want to know what's justice and judgment, destruction's going to come their way, because they're going to go right on working their lawlessness. So to know the law and liberate you from that, frees you from it, it brings you joy. Now, that is always striking to me, having been brought up as a Baptist, and they always talk about the curse of the law. What a curse that old law is, yoke of bondage. And yet, look all the time God says about the law. Verse 16, the man that wanders out of the way of understanding shall remain in the congregation of the dead. So until we want to understand, until we come to the place in our life that it doesn't just happen and we don't just follow the crowd, we've got to come to the place that we want to understand. But a man that wanders out of the way of understanding is, he just dead. He just exists. His life passes, comes and goes, ends up in death. He never really knew what his purpose was all the time he was alive. So all of his life he remains in the congregation of those that are spiritually blind and dead. Verse 17, another dollar proverb, as well as one for wine. He that loves pleasure shall be a poor man. He that loves wine and oil shall not be rich. Now, of course, there are two distinct statements there. For someone that just loves pleasure, going, spending, buying, eating out, going to all kinds of activities, he that loves pleasure shall be a poor man. But a man that loves wine and oil, maybe that's a little more dignified, a little bit more highbrow life, he likes wine with all the special meals and oil, then he won't be rich, though. He may not be poor like the previous man that loves pleasures, but he'll never be rich, because he's going to spend it all up trying to live at that fancy standard of wine and oil. Verse 18, the wicked shall be a ransom for the righteous, and the transgressor for the upright. So sooner or later, the wicked and the transgressor get caught up with, and they pay their penalty, and then you'll learn a lesson, and it'll keep you from going that way. So in a sense, it ransomed you. It made you stay upright and righteous, because if you don't envy the wicked and don't get greedy after the transgressor, you just stay and watch long enough, then you're going to realize they might seem for a time to prosper and get away with their wickedness and transgression, but sooner or later they pay for it. And here, like above, it's better to dwell in the wilderness, in the land of the desert, the Hebrew says. It's better to dwell in the desert than with a contentious and an angry woman. Now that adds a little bit more to it. This time, she's not just contentious, but angry. So now you'd be better off out here in Death Valley as a lone prospector. Verse 20, another dollar proverb. There is treasure to be desired in oil in the dwelling of the wise, but a foolish man spends it up. So another verse defining a fool as well. A fool then is a man that never saves, he just spends it up. Just lives from check to check and hand to mouth and pleasure, 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 and eat, drink, and be merry. And a foolish man spends it up. But if you're wise, then in your dwelling is going to be treasure. You're going to save, and God's going to bless you. and then you'll have the treasure that's to be desired in oil. He that follows after righteousness and mercy finds life, righteousness, and honor. You know, when you look back through the history of man, that's really true. And you think about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and David, and those men. Anyone that's followed after righteousness and mercy has found honor. And they found life. They're assured of eternity. And they found righteousness. So we just have to motivate ourselves to keep following after those three. And a wise man scales the city of the mighty and cast down the strength of the confidence thereof. In other words, you really understand about the mighty, that he may seem to glory and prosper and have power in his day, but you know that's never lasting. That's not what it looks to be either. The man that's in that city might be worried with ulcers. He might be unhappy. He might be a Tommy Manville, and yet he doesn't really have the values in life. You've got to follow after what the verse above said to really find life. So you tear down the city of the mighty because you see through it. You understand it. You see better than what it appears. Verse 23, a tongue verse. Whoso keeps his mouth and his tongue. Now, it's kind of unusual that God would use a word like keeping the Sabbath, keeping the feast. You keep your mouth, which means you've got to stop it ahead of time. You've got to control it. You've got to possess it. You've got to own it and rule it. Whoso keeps his mouth and his tongue, keeps his soul from troubles. Verse 24, proud and haughty scorner is his name who deals in proud wrath, in the wrath of pride. So here again, getting back to the scorner, God has a great deal to say about that attitude of scorn, sarcasm, ridicule, kind of bad-mouthing any other thing. So the scorner, proud and haughty, that's his name. Verse 25 and 26, two more dollar proverbs. The desire of the slothful kills him. He's always wanting so much, always wanting anything and everything, and he never really has much, so he's always wanting all kinds of things because he never has them. So that's what actually kills him. His hands refuse to labor. He covets greedily all the day long. But the righteous, his life is totally different. Now, he has to give. He has that he can give without sparing. But the slothful, because his hands refuse to labor, he never does have. He's just always flooded with desire, always covets greedily. So that just tears up his very existence. Verse 27, the sacrifice of the wicked is abomination. So there again, you can't get just and righteous by the law of sacrifice. If you're wicked by nature, you can sacrifice all you want. God looks on it as an abomination. Then how much more if someone brings it with a wicked mind, which apparently Cain did, rebellious, independent. He wasn't going to do it the way God said do it, like Abel did. He was going to bring what he pleased and how he pleased and when he pleased and if he pleased. And so for Cain to bring it with a wicked mind, that was even more than an abomination. God didn't accept the man or his offering. You remember the story back there very plainly. But God did have respect to Abel and to his offering because he brought firstly. He brought what God had commanded by law. A false witness shall perish, but the man that hears speaking constantly. But the man that hears speaks constantly. So you can't, you know, in the multitude of words, there doesn't lack sin. So you can't always be going around saying this and that and the other. You know, if you weren't allowed to say anything that you couldn't prove, how much would you say? You know, I've run into that in going through divorce-free marriage cases where someone makes suggestions. They make insinuations. They say, I think from this kind of conduct, he must have been this and he must have been that. And you can't do that. That's not a Christian that makes insinuations, that drops digs like that. You can't prove. God says, a false witness shall perish. So you better be careful about what you say against somebody if you can't prove it. If you don't know it. You know, gossip's the truth. When you say things you don't know, that's a false witness. And that's condemned even in the very Ten Commandments, you know. Well, that's important in God's sight. A wicked man hardens his face. So the more you go wrong, the harder and more callous and the less chance of being turned around you're going to be. That's one of the fears of becoming wicked. You know, that ought to be one of the fears of sin. The more you let yourself do it, the less chance you ever have of quitting doing it. And the more you go the way of lawlessness or rebellion or wickedness, the less chance you have. One of these days you may go beyond the place where you can quit and turn around. So that's a fright about playing around with going the wrong way. How do you know when you may just go that way once too often when you can't turn around, quit anymore? So a wicked man hardens his face. But as for the upright, he runs his own life. He's got his life in charge. He doesn't live accidentally. His nature doesn't just steamroll him and railroad him. The upright has control and directs his life. He's in charge of it. He thinks and plans. But the wicked, just the opposite suggestion is that he just gets caught up in his very wicked nature that's hardened in him, and he doesn't think about it. It becomes habit. Verse 30, there is no wisdom nor understanding nor counsel against the eternal. So if God said something, then you ought to remember that. Don't listen to anybody. Let God be true and every man a liar. So no matter who it is who comes along like Satan did with Eve and said, well, has God really said that? Surely God doesn't say you're to pay three tithes or you're to go to the place that he chose to keep the feast. Surely God doesn't say you can't be married three or four times. No. Just remember that verse 30. There can never be any wisdom that would stand against God's counsel. There is no understanding. There is no counsel that would ever stand against the eternal. So take God's word for it and don't let anybody water it down or talk you out of it or reason around it. The horse is prepared against the day of battle. In other words, you can do all the preparing you want. You can get your weaponry, you can get everything, but there isn't any safety in any of that. The safety is of the eternal. No matter how much preparation, no matter how numerous your forces, and you learn that all the way through the Bible. So I've got CO written across verse 31, conscientious objector. Because that warns me that I can remember in the Bible where armies were outnumbered 10 to 1 and the lesser foe whipped them. And I can remember where armies outnumbered the others 10 to 1 and they didn't even kill a one. They got lost in the woods or the walls fell over. Your safety is of the eternal. It's not a matter of your weaponry and how. You know, when you hear about American arms build up against the Russians, you feel more safe. Well, no reason to. That's a good verse to remember when you read the newspapers or news magazines or watch TV and you're comparing the military might of America and Russia, and that doesn't have anything to do with it. Safety is of the eternal, not the horse that's prepared against the day of battle. Right, chapter 22. A good name is rather to be chosen strength and great riches. So you're going to be a rich man, a Rockefeller or a Kennedy, or you'd rather just be a good name, an average man, a good neighbor, a good neighbor Sam. A good name is rather to be chosen than great riches. Loving favor rather than silver and gold. Now, it kind of shows you what happens to you when you get rich. It's hard to have loving favor and have gold and silver and riches, great riches. And anybody with a good name is better off than the millionaires and the wealthy. Because when you get right down to it, the rich and poor meet together because God's made both of them. Some people just had more natural ability to gain and produce materially, and others didn't. So they meet together in that God made both of them, and God says to have a good name is better than the wealthy. Verse 22. This has been said several times. A prudent man foresees the evil. A wise man sees trouble ahead and avoids it. A prudent man foresees the evil and hides himself. But the simple pass on and are punished. So you can brand yourself a simple if you're not the kind that can see trouble ahead. If you're the kind that always wakes up in the middle of your trouble, then you've been simple, because to end up in your trouble once, you might be able to blame it. But to do it twice, you have to blame yourself. Verse 4, another financial. By being humble and having the fear of the eternal, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, they were all rich. David was rich. You don't read in the Bible about poor Christians to any big extent. Average Christians, some poor. But if you have humility and the fear of the eternal, that's the right way to get riches and honor and life. Thorns and snares are in the way of the froward or perverse. He that does keep his soul shall be far from them. So here it deals with company you keep again. If you see someone that's perverse, then you better keep your soul far from them. Otherwise, you're going to end up in their snares and thorns. Train up a child in the way he should go, and he'll never leave it. Now, that isn't what that said. That's one of the worst mistakes we've made, you know, in the church. We've always thought that if we did our job, just a great job of dealing with our children the way we ought to. You know, it's kind of funny to me. Everybody that has little kids always takes that verse to say that, because it gives them hope to think that, boy, if you do your job, I mean, if you really did the job you should do, you're guaranteed they're going to stay right with it forever. And so everybody that's got little kids always believes that. And then when their kids get on up to 10 years, they finally find out what it really says, because that isn't what it says. Now, there are several mighty important words in this scripture. First place, the word train up literally means fence in. The first chapter of Deuteronomy really tells you how to do that. Verse 39. So you might want to jot that down there. Deuteronomy 1, verse 39. Fence in. Have him restrained by your religion. Now, the next key word is child. When they get up to be teenagers, it's a little bit too late to fence in. And maybe they will, maybe they won't. So when they're children, you can fence them in. They do everything with you. You have them learn about tithing, learn about holy days, learn about the Sabbath. Everything you do, you have them doing with you, and tell them why you're doing it, like God always says in the Bible. When they ask you what's all this mean, then you tell them. So if you fence up a child in the way he should go. Now, you know, even the way that's worded ought to tell you that he may not always stick with it. You're training him up in the way he should go. And when he is old, Now, you can never find God defining that clause, because it depends on God. You know, God calls everybody when he knows it's their best time. So if God hadn't called somebody's kids, then maybe he's going to wait another time. He's not calling them to please you. He's going to call them when it's best for them. So, you know, our young people aren't cut off from God. They're holy. They're sanctified. But that doesn't mean they're converted. It doesn't mean they're necessarily going to be converted. They can be if they want to be, and maybe even all of them aren't going to be. But God says, when he is old, how long did it take Isaac or Jacob? You remember how old Jacob was? You know, Isaac was the type of Christ. Isaac was the type of God the Father in some of the cases where he was the one who's going to be sacrificed. He was a type of the Christ. And yet, in another sense, he was a type of the church. But how old was Jacob before he made up his mind which way he was going to go? You remember how many times Jacob, even back where he finally said he tithed, he said, "Now, the God of my father, Abraham and Isaac," he wasn't his God yet. And he said, "If he be with me and keep me, then I'll give him the tithe." But he hadn't made up his mind yet whether he was going to give his life to God or go God's way. But God says, you train up a child in the way he should go. That's your job. The last part of the job, you can't do anything about that. That's God's job. When he is old, he will not depart from it. That's God's promise. That's God's part. And one of these days, maybe we'll be real Christians and not condemning one another, because I never fail to see people who have little kids always judging everybody that's got teenagers. And then when theirs get up to be teenagers, the next bunch has come along and all their little kids, they're condemning them. And they're having their trials, you know. They're in the proving period instead of the training period. So that verse is mighty important. You get the whole meaning of that verse. Fence in or train up a child. Leviticus 19:3 tells you how to do that. Ezekiel 14:16 tells you how to do that. They practice God's way all of their young life with you. And then later on, God will open their mind and recall it in their mind, and they'll be back again. Okay, verse 7. The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. And you know that's true. If you've ever owned anybody money, you always felt servant. Same way with the rich. It's as if they rule over you. They own the stores, and they own the oil companies, and they own the automobile factories, and they own everything else. And all of your life, the rich always rule over the poor all the lives. Verse 8, he that sows iniquity shall reap vanity, and the rod of his anger shall fail. The margin's better translated there. It's actually the rod of his anger that causes him to fail, or that consumes him. In other words, his very anger is what does him in, what puts an end to him. Verse 9, another dollar proverb, he that has a bountiful eye shall be blessed, because he gives of his bread to the poor. Now, if you don't think you have enough, you don't give, but if you think you've got plenty, well, you know, we can get by, we've got enough, oh, we can afford that. So a man that gives of his bread to the poor does so because he does have a bountiful eye. And because he does give of his bread to the poor, that's a loan to God, and God pays you back. God's going to bless you if you have a bountiful eye and give of your bread to the poor. Verse 10, you know, there's always a reason God repeats these verses. Some of them he repeats almost word for word. Cast out the scorner, and contention shall go out. Yea, strife and reproach will cease if you get the rotten apple and a rotten egg. He that loves pureness of heart, for the grace of his lips, the king shall be his friend. So even a king who's capable of rising to that high of capacity is going to appreciate someone that has a pure heart, someone that has gracious lips. The king will be a friend to somebody like that. Now, the eyes of the eternal preserve knowledge, but he overthrows the words of the transgressor. So, mere talk of transgressors never works out, never is accurate, never is productive. But God's eyes preserve knowledge, so see things through God's eyes and take God's word for it. Here the slothful man says, "There's a lion without. I'll be slain in the streets." So here are all these excuses why he can't go to work, can't find a job, can't get out. Verse 14, "The mouth of a strange woman." Now the word strange in the Hebrew means alien. It literally means someone other than your own wife, that's your own flesh and blood. "The mouth of alien women is a deep pit." So don't let yourself get enticed by them. You listen to a foreigner and you think maybe you could be better married to them than you could one of your own, and don't let that happen to you. The mouth of the alien is a deep pit. "He that is abhorred of the eternal shall fall therein." Now, the only reason you're abhorred of the eternal is because you won't listen to him and you won't take his word for anything and you defy what he says. So you're showing your abhorrence of what God says, so you're going to fall into that deep pit, and you're going to fall for the mouth of an alien woman, either in adultery or fornication or else in intermarriage or in whatever way. In all those ways it applies. Verse 15, kids, foolishness is bound in the heart of a child. Now you have to be careful you distinguish what's foolishness. The Apostle Paul said, "When I was a child, I spoke as a child, I thought as a child, I played like a child, and when I became a man, I put away childish things." So there are things that are just childish that aren't foolishness. What do you expect here when it says foolishness is bound in the heart of a child? What does that mean? Foolishness. Well, maybe destructiveness. Maybe selfishness. Maybe competition. They want whatever anybody else has got instead of what they've got, unless they start wanting it, and then they want it. And you can just sit around and watch kids. That's easy to do. But don't ever distinguish, don't ever confuse childishness with foolishness, because one's allowed and the other isn't. So in the heart of a child, God says, Satan has broadcast and foolishness gets bound up in it, accumulates, stores up, wells up within them. But the rod of correction, that's how you drive foolishness far from them. Don't let them get away with selfishness, competition, tantrums. Don't let them get away with foolishness. I've seen people misunderstand that, and they wanted little kids to be tiny adults. They wanted little kids to talk adult talk and not play kids' play, act like adults. Well, verse 16, here's again the way salesmen are. "He that oppresses the poor to increase his riches." Almost all sales companies tell you that. When the students went over to the Midwest to spend the summer in book sales, they all learned and were told that those are the houses to call on. Don't go to the millionaires area. Don't go to the real rich areas. They could care less what things cost. They want the millions to go to the store and buy them. So the place to sell is lower middle class or the poor people. That's what God condemns. "He that oppresses the poor to increase his riches, and he that gives to the rich shall surely come to want." So when you think about what all God had to say about the rich, we all ought to be thanking God we're not rich. You know, you ever thank God day by day that you're not rich? I don't think most people would ever do that. You know, they wouldn't mind being rich. They'd say, well, like in the Fiddler on the Roof, you know, and they said, well,
wealth is a curse. And he said, well, may the Lord smite me with a double dose, you know. One man, you know, said, don't give me wealth, lest I be spoiled and forget you, and don't give me poverty. You know, you ever pray that prayer? That one man did right out of the Bible. Verse 17, bow down your ear and hear the words of the wise, and apply your heart unto my knowledge. Now, you can consciously do that, you know, when you get a chance to hear Mr. Armstrong. Bow down your ear and hear the words of the wise. Make yourself pay attention. I can't help but be amused when you're sitting in church, and I used to do this on purpose when Mr. Scotch or Mr. Filippello or somebody would be preaching and I was sitting out in the crowd, and women go out with their babies. I just deliberately look straight ahead, not even let myself even notice that they're going, because I wanted to listen to what's being said. But you know, most people sit there and everybody comes and goes, and everybody comes and goes, and here they go. That's not inclining your ear. That's not bowing down your ear. You know, God says, get a hold of yourself. Rule yourself. Bow down your ear. Apply your heart to God's knowledge. Because it's a pleasant thing if you keep them within you. The words of the wise, it's a pleasant thing if you keep them within you. They'll withal be fitted in your lips. They'll come back out of you then. So you become wise by bowing down your ear and applying your heart to the wisdom and knowledge of the wise, that your trust may be in the eternal. I've made known to you this day to you. Haven't I written to you excellent things and counsels and knowledge? So now he's kind of giving you an admonition at the end of this group of Psalms to let you realize what all he's been giving you here. Haven't I written to you excellent things and counsels and knowledge? Haven't I done this that I might make you know the certainty of the words of truth? They're absolute. They're 100%. They can't fail. They're guaranteed. The certainty of the words of truth, that you might answer the words of truth to them that send to you. Now, after that five verse, those all five verses tie together, 17 through 21, so you might just circle each verse number and chain them all together there, because they're all one successive admonition. Now he comes back to the individual Proverbs, verse 22. Rob not the poor because he is poor. Now that goes right back up to verse 16, you notice. So on both sides of this inset admonition about appreciating the wisdom of God's words, he comes right back where he left off, verse 16, about robbing the poor. That's what salesmen do. Neither oppress the afflicted in the gate. They can do that too, you know. People that are widows, people that are elderly, people that are crippled, they can defraud, as the word oppress is also in the Hebrew, they can defraud the afflicted in the gate. Because the eternal will plead their cause. So when you take on the poor and the afflicted, you're asking for trouble from God. God is their avenger. The eternal will plead their cause and spoil the soul of those that spoil them. So you don't get away with taking from the poor, defrauding the poor, because God's going to take it back from you. God is going to spoil the soul of those that spoil the poor. Verse 24 on anger. Make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man, don't keep company. Don't mingle with him or keep company with him, lest you learn his ways and get a snare to your soul. So whoever you keep company with is going to rub off on you. You can't help it. So if you keep company or make a friendship with somebody that's hot-headed and blows their cork and builds up steam and blows their top, you're going to learn his ways, and it's going to end up being a snare on your life. Verse 26, surety. Another verse on surety. Don't be one of those that strike hands or those that are sureties for debts. Now, you'd think with all these admonitions, nobody would ever be surety for anybody else. And yet, a lot of people are. They think it's proving your friendship and your closeness and all. Well, God warns you, you may be friendly and close with somebody, and later that's broken. So don't you be one of those that strike hands. If you have nothing to pay, why should he take away your bed from under you? That's what they'll do. You think those finance companies won't do that? Send out the collectors and send out the legal firms, and they'll take away your bed right out from under you. Maybe put you in jail. Don't remove the ancient landmark which your fathers have set. Get a little more land than really ought to belong to you, and claim land that really never was yours. Do you see a man diligent in his business? He'll stand before kings. He'll not stand before obscure men. So there's a great admonition for diligence. You're going to go places. You're going to succeed. You're going to climb in the world strictly by hard work, by diligence, by persistency. Of course, I think of Mr. Armstrong when I read that verse, because he's certainly been diligent in God's business. I've never known any man as single-minded in my life as he is. You know, at least other people, you can get to go to a movie or fool around and waste some time playing ball or something, you know. But you don't ever get him to do that. He just got one desire in mind every day, all the time. When you sit to eat with a ruler, consider diligently what's before you, and put a knife to your throat if you be a man given to appetite. So this is the condemnation of people wining and dining others. They're up to something, you know. They're going to snag you and snare you one way. So be on guard against somebody taking advantage of you by setting you up in that way. That doesn't necessarily mean a king, or to use the word king, but a ruler in a business or a ruler in a anyway. Don't be desirous of his dainties. They're deceitful meat. So all three of those verses tie right together. They warn you about being a party to what so many companies do nowadays when they mix business with all kinds of corruption. Okay, verse 4. Don't labor to be rich. Now that's really an odd statement. Well, that's almost as if, why would you want to be rich? That's going to be bad. That's going to be a curse more than likely. Don't labor to be rich. Cease from your own wisdom. It's not wise to labor to be rich. Now, that might seem so humanly. That's your own wisdom humanly, but you've got to cease from that kind of wisdom. Now, well, why do you labor then? Well, 1 Timothy 6, verses 9 and 10, you know, says that a person that stole ought to steal no more, but labor that he might have to give to those that have need. Ephesians 4 and verse 28 give you another reason, too, why you don't labor to be rich. Well, you enjoy your labor while you're working. But don't have a motive or have that. How many people have you known of whose ambition was to be millionaires before they reached 30? They feed you on that, you know. You get all kinds of material out of newspapers on that. Here's a man that was a millionaire before he's 30. You want to know his secrets? Here they are. Apply these secrets and you'll be a millionaire before you're 30. Well, who wants to be? You want to be cursed before you're 30? God says, don't labor to be rich. That's no motive for working. That's no motive for... That'll wreck your family. A lot of men are married to their careers. And their wife has kids and all of a sudden their kids grow up and they're gone away from home and their business is built up to where somebody else can take it over, and the guy says, well, boy, where'd life go? You know, I thought I married a young, beautiful lady, and where'd my kids go? And where's my home, you know? And where'd my wife go? And, well, their life was their career, and they broke this scripture. Well, you set your eyes upon that which is not. That isn't really what your purpose is. That's not real success. That's not any real goal. Why will you set your eyes on that which isn't? Being rich. Riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away like an eagle toward heaven. But Satan's filled a lot of people's heads with the desire and the appreciation of being rich and wanting to be rich and envying the rich. And now verses 6, 7, and 8 tie together. Eat you not the bread of him that has an evil eye, neither desire you his dainty meats. It's kind of a contrast with the first three verses up here about sitting to eat with a ruler without recognizing what's happening. You're going to be wined and dined, and then when you're fed and drunk, you're going to get in trouble. So don't eat the bread of him that has an evil eye. Don't you desire his dainty meats. As he thinks in his heart, so is he. Eat and drink, says he to you, but his heart's not with you. He's doing that for a purpose. He's got an ulterior motive. Down underneath his outward pats on the back and flamboyancy and his heart's not with you. The morsel that you've eaten, you're going to vomit up and wish you'd never eaten it. You're going to lose your sweet words that were going on between the two of you as you lied to each other. You see that all the time between politicians. You see that among business people. Okay, verse 9. Don't speak in the ears of a fool. He'll despise the wisdom of your words. So there's another reason you can't keep company with fools. Because if you ever open your mouth with anything of wisdom, he's a fool. He's not going to hear it. He's going to despise it. Remove not the old landmark. Enter not into the fields of the fathers. So God knows how materialistic humans are. And boy, when you read through the Proverbs, you realize how materialistic people are, how their whole life is in get, possess, own, cheat, fraud, corrupt, bribe. You know, maybe Solomon, after all, realized a lot of people didn't know. He was sure in a position to see it. Enter not into the fields of the fatherless, because their Redeemer is mighty. He'll plead their cause with you. Of course, the gleanings belong to the fatherless and the widows and the strangers and anybody else that's fatherless. You don't take advantage of their youth or their newness or their lack of experience or wisdom. God will take you to task for it. Apply your heart to instruction, verse 12, your ears to the words of knowledge. So there again, you have to, it takes character, it takes willpower. You have to drive yourself to it. Apply your heart. Verse 13 on kids, don't withhold correction from the child. Now, this is rotten translating in the King James. If you beat him with a rod, he'll not die. Killed him or something. That isn't what that's saying at all. It's just saying discipline is good for human nature. The nerve endings are back there where you use the switch or the stick, you know. If you spank with a rod, it's not in violence. That's what he's saying. If you spank with a rod, it isn't done in revenge or violence or hot-headed anger. It's to correct the wrongness of the nature. It's to correct the foolishness that's built up in him from birth. So when you withhold correction, you're not cleansing his inward parts. But if you spank him with the paddle or switch him with a switch or discipline him with discipline, you're not doing it to hurt him. You're not doing it out of vengeance with the danger of killing him. You're only doing it out of love and teaching with correction. It's too bad that wasn't any better translated. That's an abomination to the scriptures, the way that's translated. Go ahead and spank him with the paddle. You'll deliver his soul from hell. And now he comes back to my son. So right after he admonishes the parent, now he comes to the son. My son, if your heart be wise, my heart shall rejoice, even mine. So So even God's heart rejoices when a heart's, when a son's heart is wise as well as parent. Yea, my rain shall rejoice when your lips speak right things. So God rejoices over children that are taught the right way. Don't let your heart envy sinners. Now, God, that's something you have to aggressively do. Otherwise, it's going to do it. When you drive down through the rich parts of town, you know good and well your heart envies sinners. When you see what people have you don't have, you see somebody drive by in their big white whatever car they've got, you know, don't let your heart envy sinners. You be in the fear of the eternal all the day long. You're going to be better off just fearing God and taking His word for what He says and not envy the sinners. That's something that's hard to do. You watch television and you see these big shots on television, whether they're movie actors or politicians or public citizens or whatever they are, and it's hard not to sit there and let your heart envy. Well, you know, you wish you were famous, or you wish you were a little better off, wealthy, or you know, you wish you were in their category. Surely there's an end, and your expectations shall not be cut off. In other words, at the end, if you have the fear of the eternal, your expectation is going to be great. But what's their expectation? They come to their end as well. But what's their end? What's their reward? Well, they're getting it while they're living in wealth and prestige. But your main reward is at the end. Hear you, my son, and be wise and guide your heart in the way. So now after he admonishes the son to have wisdom and not envy sinners and to consider the end, all those verses tie together. Now verse 19 goes right on. So all these verses, 15 through 19 and 20 and on down, all tie together. Now look at this admonition of a son. Hear you, my son, and be wise. Get a hold of your life. Take the reins of your life. Guide your heart in the way. Don't let yourself just follow peer pressure and be among wine bibbers, among riotous eaters of flesh. Because the drunkard and the glutton are going to come to poverty, and drowsiness is going to clothe a man with rags. Hearken to your father that begat you, and don't despise your mother when she's old. Now, over and over, this whole segment's all about the father's admonition to a son, all the way to the end of this chapter. So one of the problems parents have to get across to their kids is partying, drinking, and overeating, running around wrong eating, wretched diets, and overeating, riotous ears of flesh. That word is so vivid. You see people on TV. I saw a guy on a commercial late last night, and here he is just sitting there cramming all kinds of foods down him. Looks like, you know, he looks like he weighs 500 pounds already. And when you think about some of the modern-day hippie types with the hair all over them and dirty clothes and all fat and everything, and boy, that's what that verse is talking about. Wine bibbers, riotous eaters of flesh, boasting about how much liquor they can hold, how much beer they can drink. Boy, they can drink six packs, one right after the other, and go right on eating and drinking. Well, God warns His sons not being among those kinds. Look at the end. Where are they going to end up? Mental cases, sterile, broken homes, beat up their children. The drunkard and the glutton are going to come to poverty, and drowsiness is going to clothe them with rags. But a wise son is going to hearken to his father that begat him, and he's not going to let himself despise his mother as she gets older. Now there again, why would a son tend to do that? Why would God pick that area to warn a son about, despising his mother when she's old, and not hearken to his father? Well, it's a different reaction to the dad. He's trying to tell him things and trying to get across to him, and he's a man, and he resents things, and so he warns him, hearken to your father. Don't despise your mother. Buy the truth. Don't treat it cheaply. Don't trample it underfoot. Listen to it. Accept it. Buy the truth. Don't sell it for any wine and gluttony and harlotry. Don't sell it for anything like that. Buy wisdom and instruction and understanding. Don't sell them for corruption, for physical, temporary things. The father of the righteous shall greatly rejoice, and he that begets a wise child shall have joy of him. Your father and your mother shall be glad, and she that bare you shall rejoice. My son, give me your heart, and let your eyes observe my ways. Now the next thing he warns them about after eating and drinking is whoring around. A whore is a deep ditch. An alien woman is a narrow pit. She lies in ways for a prey and increases the transgressors among men. Because humans have that drive and that weakness, so the harlot just increases the transgressors among men and lies in ways for a prey. Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has contentions and babbling? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes? Well, these wild livers that tarry along at the wine, these that go out to seek mixed wine, that can't even wait till it's fully fermented, that look on it even while it's still fermenting, while it's giving its color and moving itself, but at the last it's going to bite like a serpent and it's going to sting like an adder. And when you've gone that way of wine, women, and song, your eyes are going to behold strange women. And your mind is going to utter perverse things. Drunken babble. Gluttonous babble. Dope head babble. Yea, you're going to be as he that lies down in the midst of the sea. Seasick, out on a ship. One of the worst feelings you can have. You could wish you were dead. There's no way around it. He that lies on the top of a mast. You don't even know a wound. You can tear yourself while you're drunk and doped up and they've stricken me. I wasn't sick. They've beaten me. I didn't feel it. Why? When I wake up, I'm going to go right back like a dog in my vomit again. I'm going to seek it yet again. Boy, that is. You've taken the last parts of that chapter bit by bit, but don't ever do that. Beginning with verse 15, that's all one story, one theme through there. Now he comes around to a new thoughts again. Don't you be envious against evil men, neither desire to be with them. And literally, you just have to grab your thoughts and brain and say, watch out, don't do that. God says, don't be envious against evil. God says, don't desire to be with them, because you will by nature. You, their heart studies destruction, their lips talk of mischief. Through wisdom, the house is builded. By understanding, a house is established. By knowledge, the chambers are filled with all precious and pleasant riches. It doesn't just happen, you know. People don't have nice homes and nice lives and nice jobs accidentally. It's through wisdom, through understanding, by knowledge. A wise man is in strength. Yea, a man of knowledge increases strength. So that's stability and strength. Wisdom and knowledge, because by wise counsel you make your war, and in multitude of counselors there's safety. Less likely for plans to go awry and purposes to fail, the more counselors you have. Wisdom is too high for a fool, though. He doesn't open his mouth in the gate. Wisdom is beyond his capacity to even realize it is wisdom. He's gone the way of foolishness so much he doesn't even appreciate wisdom. Someone that devises to do evil shall be called a mischievous person. The thought of foolishness is sin. So they get so steeped in their foolishness that even their thinking is all in the line of sin. The scorner is an abomination to men. Once you get calloused and embittered and hardened and sarcastic and negative, and I'll tell you, I don't want to be a scorner. All the things we've read in the Proverbs about a scorner, boy, that's one thing you don't ever want to let yourself become. To men, the scorner is an abomination. Well, we already read he was to God, now he even is to men. Who likes to be around somebody like that? No matter anything you bring up, it's scorn, sarcasm, negative, disbelief, put down. If you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small. So a good way to measure your strength is, how do you stand up with trials? You get sick, first thing you do is go to the doctor. Well, your strength is small. Don't think you're strong. Don't think you're Philadelphian. No, don't think you have a lot of faith. If in the day of adversity, when you're face to face with lying or being embarrassed and you lie, your strength is small. If you're pressed financially and you steal your tithe, you fainted in the day of adversity. Your strength is small. You visit your kin folks, and first thing you know, they're drafting you into their Christmas party, and you don't know how to get out of it, so rather than be embarrassed, you just kind of go along with it. Your strength is small if you faint in the day of adversity. If you forbear to deliver them that are drawn unto death and those that are ready to be slain, if you say, behold, we didn't know it. Doesn't he that ponders the heart consider it? He that keeps your soul, doesn't he know it? Shall not he render to every man according to his works? So human nature always has an excuse, you know. If you don't help those that are sick, those that are in the process of dying, even worse, spiritually, headed toward death. If you see someone going the way of death spiritually and you forbear to deliver him by some excuse, well, I didn't really know it. I thought maybe I felt, I perceived. One of the hardest things it is, though, is to level with somebody, you know. Talk straight turkey and tell somebody like it is. You're always wanting their favor. You're always wanting their respect. So you're always tending to befriend somebody when you ought to be level with them. So remember what God says about that. If you forbear to deliver a brother that's being drawn to death spiritually with some kind of a lame duck excuse saying, well, I didn't really know it. God knows your heart. God, who keeps the soul, doesn't he know? He's going to render to you just like you did to some other brother. So he's going to reward you according to your works, and you had a chance to deliver a brother and you didn't do it. You wanted his praise and respect carnally. Well, now he comes back to my son again. My son, eat you honey because it's good, and the honeycomb which is sweet to your taste. But that's only the physical part of the analogy. Now, you could give a whole sermon on why God said honey is good. If you've never read that one chapter in Folk Medicine by Dr. Jarvis, you ought to read that one chapter he has in there about honey. That beats anything you ever read. You know, honeycomb is good for stopping bedwetting. Honeycomb is good for arthritis. And honeycomb is good for a lot of ailments. You know, honey itself is a mild laxative. It's a quick energy. It's a, you know, they haven't found a germ that can live 3 minutes in honey. You can take impetigo that can live on a piece of wood a year, and you coat it with honey and it's dead in 3 minutes. Boy, that's some chapter. You know, there's another book out about alcohol. You'll never find but one book ever written that's pro-alcohol. You know, every other book you'll ever find is always written against alcohol. But there's one written, it's called Liquor, the Servant of Man. Now, that's a rare book, needless to say, because somebody's bought up all the copies they could and burned them. But I've got one of them they're not going to burn, and it's an excellent book. You know, it's weird. It shows how wine is the only thing they've found that can cause your pancreas to be stimulated to working again, and yet if you take very much wine when you have diabetes, it'll kill you. And yet if you just sip a little bit and a little bit and a little bit, you know, from day to day to day, it's the only thing that'll start your pancreas back up to work again. Well, liquor, the servant of man. Well, there's a lot about that we don't know. But can you imagine a germ not being able to live 3 minutes in honey? Well, God says, my son, eat you honey, because it is good, and the honeycomb is sweet to your taste. Now, he warns you a little later about not eating too much of it, because it's like wine. It can kill you, too. There have been examples of armies that were fatigued, and they decided what they needed to do was guzzle down a bunch of honey so they'd have quick energy and the heat of battle, and they died from overdoing it. I can read that out of the land in the book, is the name of the book that has that in it. Well, notice the spiritual parallel with this physical comment. In the same way that you're to eat honey because it's good, the same way you should, the knowledge of wisdom is the same way to your soul. So the Jews, with each sentence they teach a little baby, put a piece of honey in their mouth along with it. And later on, they use a little bit of wine to put on with it. So they teach them knowledge is sweet. Knowledge is yummy. It's tasty. It's good. And they do that from the time they're little. Well, in a way, God is saying that here. So shall the knowledge of wisdom be like honey to you. It'd be good. So when you found knowledge, then it'll be sweet to your taste, like the honeycomb. There'll be a reward. Your expectation shall not be cut off. In other words, your end result will be everlasting life. What your goal is and your purpose for the future is sure. Unlike the wicked, their end is they're cut off. They're dead. Lay not wait, O wicked man, against the dwelling of the righteous. Spoil not his resting place. Because the just man might fall seven times and rise up again, but the wicked will fall into mischief. Now, don't ever use verse 16 to justify sinning seven times. You know, some have even translated that way. They've translated it, a just man falls seven times in sin. And it doesn't say that. Notice that's the last part of a parallel. Verse 15 and 16 go together. What he's saying here is, if someone who's wicked lies in wait against the dwelling of the righteous and spoils his resting place, a just man might fall under the hand of the wicked seven times, so he's going to rise up again, but not the wicked. Boy, when they fall, that's going to be the end. They're going to be cut off in their end of their fall. They're going to fall into mischief. So a just man might suffer calamity. He might have floods and lightning and accidents. A just man might fall seven times, but he's going to rise up again. But once the fall of the wicked comes, that's the end of him. Now, take that verse in context. And now verse 17 and 18 are another duet. Don't rejoice when your enemy falls. Don't let your heart be glad when he stumbles. Because Christ said, you know, do good to those who despitefully use you and pray for those who persecute you. You know, you can heap coals of shame on your head. So don't let your heart be glad when he stumbles, lest the eternal see it and it displease him and he turn away his wrath from him.